Welcome to this edition of This is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment. This edition is sponsored by the Tricord Group, leading successful relationship constructs for over 25 years, and VIM, helping the architecture and design disciplines design, deliver, and operate better buildings for a better world.
Greetings, I'm Dave Gilmore, and this is Design Intelligence. In the studio with me today is Phil Bernstein, well-known architect, technologist, and associate dean at the Yale School of Architecture. He's also been teaching there since 1988. He was the former vice president at Autodesk, where he was responsible for setting the company's future vision and strategy for BIM technology. And prior to being at Autodesk, Phil was a principal at Pelly Clark Pelly Architects. Also with me in the studio is Scott Simpson, an award-winning architect, a Richard Upjohn Fellow of the AIA, and a senior fellow and board member of the Design Futures Council. During the course of his 40-plus year career, he's been a principal in 5 different firms and president and CEO of 2. I'm so glad you are both with me here today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Should be a good conversation.
So our time here together is really to look into the future. It's really a time for us to explore and to highlight what are the possibilities, if not probabilities, into the future coming in and through this COVID-19 period. So when we think about that, we have been speaking and writing and podcasting and doing all kinds of communication around reinvention. We believe that this industry, the built environment industry, is indeed ripe for reinvention. Scott, you have some initial thoughts about where we could go with this idea of reinvention.
If you look at the AEC industry as a whole, it's really suboptimal. 30% of projects don't meet schedule or budget. 30% of construction materials wind up as waste. 45% is of carbon emissions come from construction. It's really a mess when you think about it. So you've got an industry which really does not work very well. And the whole value proposition is misunderstood. So COVID or not, this is a great time to reinvent construction and design.
Yeah, you know, you always need a couple of things to happen to turn the ship of state that is the AC industry. And we've got a lot of interesting technology. We've got investment in the world of technology. We've got something of an existential crisis, both economically and epidemiologically. And at least it gives us a window of opportunity to think about things in a different way.
So, Phil, I wanted to ask you, you know, coming out of technology the way you have and moving across industry, it seems that there was a significant wave, I'll call it, of initial investment into technologies to hopefully raise the bar on both the delivery, the quality, the timeliness of the design industry. But it seems as though that steady investment into technology and assimilating technology as opposed to something that's just something we do has just not really taken on as it has perhaps in other industries. I'd love to hear you talk about what do we do about really embracing technology into the core of what we do as an enabler toward this reinvented future.
Well, I think, Dave, your observation is correct, and that the building industry has episodically digitized, but not in any kind of coherent way. And I think there are 2 reasons for that. One is it's extremely difficult to get the building industry writ large to do anything in concert in a coherent way, just because of the structural nature of it, the competitive nature of it, the razor-thin margins, the strong disincentives for innovation. But the one big wave of potentially transformative technology, which is the one that I worked on, building information modeling, which was supposed to bring the building industry from its analog roots into real digital representation, really largely hasn't been leveraged. It's the architects and engineers and contractors who have taken advantage of that technology have used it primarily for what I would consider to be the edge cases of making more accurate or well-coordinated working drawings, or figuring out construction sequencing, or doing low-grade energy analysis, or extracting quantities from a model. And none of these things go to the heart of the kinds of questions that Scott posed earlier. So the technologies that we have adopted have made certain things more interesting or more efficient, but we haven't really bent the curve, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think Phil's really spot on that point. And you know, part of it is that architects and engineers get paid up until the time the ribbon on the building is cut. So their contract with an owner is transactional. They get paid for a service, basically for drawing lines on paper. But the real value of what they do does not start accruing until after the ribbon is cut. That's where the value starts to grow. And architects and engineers don't connect with that value proposition. They're thinking before the fact, they should be thinking after the fact, and structuring their contracts and their value propositions around the whole life cycle of the building.
So much of our conversation over the last couple of years has been the centrality of the owner in all of this, in this ecosystem. And yet, so often I'm in these conversations and the owner never comes up as the prime stakeholder. It's extraordinary. Yeah. But at the end of the day, so much of this revolves around how the owner either understands or doesn't understand, cares or doesn't care, decides or doesn't decide around some of these dynamics.
And just a quick thought about that, David. Owners will focus on the capital cost up front during the design and construction process. They get very, very worked up about, you know, pennies on the dollar about what it's really going to cost to put the building in place, overlooking the fact that they're going to spend 10 times that amount over the life of the building and service. And I know that Phil just wrote a great article about the health, safety, and welfare aspects of all that thing, what that really means. But if owners understood the whole life cycle, they'd think about design and construction in an entirely different way.
And I also think that you have what I would call symmetrical blindness from perspective of the owner. On the one hand, owners very much transact their business with the supply chain of the building industry in the way that Scott described. It's very transactional. I put a quarter in the slot and out come some drawings, and I put another quarter in the slot and out come some buildings, and I optimize my process for the lowest possible first cost and to also make sure that I don't take any risk for the proposition. I try to transfer the risk entirely on to the outside players. But at the same time, owners don't put demands on their building industry providers to actually correlate their work with the reasons they're building the buildings in the first place. You know, clients don't build buildings to meet schedules or budgets or even to, you know, become LEED certified. They build buildings to do things. And so the services of the building industry on the provider side are discorrelated from the things that owners want their buildings to do. And until we cross over that bridge, we're never going to be able to attack any of these problems.
You know, Phil's got a unique perspective on that because he has been an owner. He, in fact, was our client when we did the Autodesk headquarters in Waltham, Massachusetts. And he was continually reminding the design team throughout the process why that design was being done. It was not about lines on paper. It was about the people who are going to work in the building after the thing was finished.
So you're both architects. How often have you watched over the last, we'll be 20 years, let's go, or 25 years, do you hear architects or architectural firms proactively come in to the owner and say, tell me your vision. Tell me why you're doing this. Tell me what is best case for you. Not in design, but the ultimate outcomes of this building. Is that unusual?
I've had those conversations with the clients, and I try to push that up as much as I can to the forefront of the discussion. A lot of clients don't know the deep-seated reasons why they're doing it. You know, I need my dorm to finish in September. I've got kids coming to campus. So we need to educate owners as much as we educate architects and engineers. There's no place to learn how to be a good owner. And if we could educate the ownership community, I think you get much better results.
And I think, when I was practicing, I think a lot of clients were pretty clear about what they wanted their buildings to do. I worked on an airport. We knew pretty precisely what we were trying to accomplish. But as my friend Scott likes to say, architects are very good at inflicting change on or advocating change for everyone except for themselves. So while as an architect, I may help the owner articulate their vision for what they want the building to do, and I might even help write the brief and execute the design, the business deal that we make is completely uncorrelated from that. And there will be a whole long list of things as the architect that I will tell the client I am not responsible for, even though they are strongly correlated to what that owner wants to be able to do with that building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me give you an example, Dave. Years ago, I worked at a firm called Pett Associates, which last year won the AA Firm of the Year Award. And they were basically a medical design firm doing hospitals and clinics. And in their process, they paid very close attention to the logistical and operations of a typical nursing unit. So ordinarily, you'd staff a nursing unit with 8 to 10 nurses for 35 patients. And they would track circulation patterns and deliveries of materials and supplies and equipment. And we discovered that by designing that unit differently, we could save one FT, one nurse, from that staffing profile. It turns out that the cost savings for that one FTE would pay for the interest on the entire bond issue that was required to build the unit. So from the early days of my career, I was inculcated with that whole mindset of what's behind the design brief and how do people behave in those buildings and what does that really mean in terms of the design process.
I often tell my students that the primary structural problem of the building industry is that we don't share any common value about the process that creates the intersections between the different pieces, except for the desire for lowest first cost. Mm. It's the kind of lowest common denominator, and I mean lowest with a capital L. Yeah. And that creates a lot of dynamics that ultimately don't serve clients very well. Yeah. I mean, an excellent example of that is statistically, a design, bid, build, delivery model where the owner commissions designers to make drawings, which are then bid by contractors, and the lowest price wins, those projects very rarely come in on budget.
Yeah,
you pick an entire strategy, it's misoptimized for what you're trying to do.
Yeah. So let me tell you another story. Years ago, we did a research lab for Novartis. They were building a brand new research headquarters in Cambridge. And when they hired us to do the building, they had one employee. By the time the building was going to be completed, they had to hire 1,000 people. So they were very smart. And they said, look, we want to create a design for this new laboratory that will inspire people to want to come work for us. Because in addition to building the building, we got to fill the building with people. So designing the building to anticipate recruiting issues was absolutely part of our design brief. And as a result, we kept track of the numbers on this. Their success in recruiting was double previous metrics. And that building was a huge success for them because by the time the building opened, they in fact had hired 1,000 people to staff the building. That building won Lab of the Year, won all kinds of design awards. It was done on a fast-track basis using BIM technology, broke all kinds of records. But the important thing for the owner was they wanted to fill that building with smart researchers to do the job. That was a great lesson for our design team to hear that.
Let's go back to your earlier example where you talk about where the architect is really a fee for service on the front end, but the real value of what the architect does is in the occupancy and beyond. And so that value is not realized, sadly, by the architecture design community because that's not in their brief, that's not in their contract. How do we, knowing now we've talked about these different genres of owners, how do we appeal to each genre with that mindset in place to where the contractual instrumentation of the architect could extend beyond the ribbon cutting on into an ongoing occupancy support? And we have different types of owners here that this would apply to.
My contention is that there's a value proposition for every single kind of building, no matter what it is. If you're a developer, you want to fill the building with paying tenants, and that should go on the table as part of the design brief. If you're an institution, if you're a medical center, if you're a university, if you're a corporate commercial client or an office client, whatever it is, there's a value proposition that underlies why that project is being done. You got to unpack that, and you got to understand from the business perspective what that really means so you can express design value in business terms and business value in design terms. What do you think, Phil?
Well, I think that's an excellent sort of operating principle that opens up a strategy that designers should begin to consider. You know, in the era of more modern technology and in an era where information can be organized and evaluated, more and more clients are operating what I'd call a more rational stand on a more rational basis. They are asking for the underlying analytics and evaluation of the information streams that lead to a decision. And the kinds of tools that are starting to emerge in the AEC industry around analytics, simulation, and prediction actually allow architects and engineers as designers to begin to use those kinds of strategies in support of design. That gives us a strategy to correlate predictive outcomes relative to the kinds of things that Scott's talking about. And that allows you to change the business proposition. The problem, I think, is that we are constantly talking about process improvement and technological innovation, but we don't strongly correlate that to a business argument. And if we don't correlate it to a business argument, it simply won't happen.
Right. So supposing I'm a hotel client, Dave, and I'm going to build a new hotel in downtown New York, and I need to hire an architect. One of my primary drivers, other than first cost, as Phil has mentioned many times, is I want to make sure my occupancy is as high as possible, because that's going to be my real business metric after the building is open. So can I hire an architect who can promise me to bring to the table ideas based on real data that are going to increase the level of occupancy over a long period of time for that hotel? If such an architect could come forth, I would really listen to that person. In addition to having the design skills, the aesthetic skills, and all the other skills that go with it, there's a whole set of skills out there about value propositions that are not talked about in the academy. They really need to be brought to the table. And that's why I'm so bullish about this profession. There is so much upside in design.
So these are really great points. You both teach. You know, Phil, you're at Yale, and Scott, you're at GSD at Harvard quite a bit. How much is this being taught? Let's just pick on those two academies. How much is this thinking being taught about business mindset, a strategic mindset in business, as well as the extrapolation of insights from data that drive to not only design outcomes, but business outcomes? How are we approaching that in our educational system at this point?
Well, I guess I'm supposed to defer to the Harvard guy first, right?
Never.
Never. I'll jump in here first.
Yeah.
So for the last 6 years, I've been teaching a course called Alternative Value Propositions to Practice. And it's open to graduate students who have some professional experience and have taken a professional practice course, either mine or elsewhere. And the purpose of the course is to interrogate the structural business models of the architectural profession and design alternative models. So the students are tasked with examining how the architecture profession converts value. In other words, what the operating and business models are, what their weaknesses are, what other more strong business models might be. And then the semester project is to propose a business that is anything that a designer might do in any realm that you feel is appropriate. And the rule is you can't convert value by hourly rate fees or fixed lump sums. You got to make your money some other way. And the results have been quite eye-opening. So I bring in innovative practitioners. I bring in people from the tech world. I bring in people from other disciplines like movie producers and technologists, so they can see a wide range of different ways of converting value propositions, and then they have to come up with their own ideas. So I'd say, at least down here in New Haven, we're attacking that problem pretty directly.
That's fantastic.
I've actually been a guest speaker for Phil a couple of times, and I've really enjoyed that course. It's a very well-structured course and very smart in how it challenges students to think outside the traditional box of professional practice. For the last 5 or 6 years, I've been teaching a course at Harvard called Good Design is Good Business. It's a deliberate investigation of exactly this issue. What are the value propositions about design that relate to the business side? And what about the business propositions that relate to the design side? Where's the sweet spot? And what's the language that connects the two realms? Because that's the language that clients are going to be really listening to. And I've said this a lot, you know, architects traditionally focus on what I call the nouns of the world, the things, the objects, the forms, the materiality of the building. That's what they focus on in school. But what they really should be focused on, in addition to that, are the processes that happen once the building is put in service. All the activities that go on, the energy consumption, the efficiencies of operations, all those kinds of things. That's where real value lies. So we have to unify those two worlds. It's like unifying the world of subatomic physics and gravitational fields at the macro scale. You got to think broadly and deeply about both of those realms and where they connect. And I think that's why in the future, designers are going to be able to offer incredible value to their clients. And I can see a day when a chief design officer is a regular participant in board meetings and corporations.
That's fantastic. You know, it really leads me back to our current status. Here we are in this COVID-19 period. We are still in the middle of it. We've been at it, at least we made the digital pivot just about 7 months ago, not quite, almost there. And we're still in this space. Given the behavior of the American people, we might be in this for a bit longer. What are our implications? Now, I want to say right up front that COVID or no COVID, we got flipped on our back. We've been exposed. All that COVID has done is accelerated the spotlight on our weaknesses and our vulnerabilities and our inadequacies. But it's a positive opportunity for us to accelerate towards something else. What should we be looking to in what we'd call near-term implications for the design community from this? And then from there, let's have a discussion more to the intermediate and long-term from this dynamic.
Well, I'd say that the almost immediate reaction for the design community is the necessity to get really smart and strategic about a bunch of issues that we might not have previously even been marginally engaged in. It was over this summer here on campus, it was very interesting to see how each kind of organizational unit responded to the question of how are you going to open your school in the fall? You know, how is business school going to do it? How is the law school going to do it? And we, of course, looked at the problem entirely as an architectural problem. We had a detailed 3D model of our building. We enlisted the help of some architects and some engineers. We began looking at space and circulation and air quality and running simulations. And we were way out ahead of a number of the other places on campus who were kind of going, okay, you know, what's the... I take a classroom, I divide it by 36 square feet, and that's how many students I can put in there. And so we immediately had to take our design skills and shift them onto a different set of problems. And we got really good at it really, really fast, so much so that I had a kind of, you know, I was kind of doing a deal. I had a deal with the dean of the School of Public Health. You know, you look at my plans for viral infection, and I'll look at your classrooms and make sure you're getting social distancing. And the need to shift the perspective about what the definition of the public's health and safety has never happened faster. And we're going to have to really think about it.
Yeah. If you look at the pandemic, nobody likes the pandemic, but there have been some really interesting positive results or positive things that have come out of it. Number one, the biotech and pharma industry has really performed superbly. To do the research they've done as fast as they've done, to come up with vaccine candidates within 10 months, that's an amazing accomplishment. And that shows how smart we can be if we put our mind to it. Also, the working from home phenomenon has forced a lot of companies to become productive in different ways than they had before. And not all that's going to survive long term, but they picked up new and different and interesting ways to do work remotely. And I think those process improvements are going to find their way embedded into different processes going forward that might have a permanent effect on the landscape.
I think one of the permanent changes is that the structural availability of talent is now completely different. Some of my students who've been lucky enough to get jobs, most of whom have been with firms either in New York or San Francisco, those people are not living in New York or San Francisco. They're living in Vermont and Kansas and, you know, New Mexico, and they are still working full time and they're fully engaged members of their firms. Now, after the pandemic ends, they may fly to those cities for a couple of days a month, but the talent network now has a completely different shape, which of course has an upside and a downside, right? You may be able to find talent anywhere, but you're going to have to, the competitive landscape is also going to be different because a bunch of well-connected, digitally enabled younger architects can form a very viable competitive virtual firm and compete with your incumbent firm pretty easily.
Yep, and they can do it out of thin air at very low capital cost. It does beg the question of how you create and enhance a collaborative culture entirely remotely. That's a real challenge, I think, because people being in the same room with each other is a different way of doing business. What do you think about that, Phil?
I don't think you have to do it. I don't think it's a binary. Mm-hmm. I think that you can have a virtual network and you can bring people together periodically as you need to do so. I mean, in my day, working in the tech industry, that's exactly what we did. We had software engineers and salespeople and marketing people spread all around the world. And when we needed to, we would fly them places and they would sit together and work. But they weren't permanently stationed in a given place. Yeah. So we've accelerated the virtualization of knowledge work. And what we're going to have to do is rebalance it. Yeah. But I can tell you, as if I'm the CEO of a large architecture firm who's got tens of thousands of spectacularly expensive square feet of space in New York right now that have been empty for 7 months, I'm going to be really seriously looking at that line in my overhead calculations going forward, because I've demonstrated I don't need all that space.
I think you're right. And that begs another question, which was, I'll call it radical repositioning. We're going to see gobs of space become available in hotels, retail, offices, even
ground floor retail. Absolutely.
So how are we going to reposition that space? Well, that's a real opportunity for design thinking. Lots and lots of square footage are going to come up. It's going to be cheap. It's going to be available. It's going to be well located. What a great opportunity for design thinkers to put their minds to that issue, come up with new ways to use that space productively.
We're talking a year from now. It's October of 2021. Let us pretend that we have been able to get COVID-19 mostly under control. Let us pretend that there is an effective array of vaccines that are now working for us. What is our best case dream for the design industry coming out of this?
Well, I think that there are a couple of dreamy scenarios. Dreamy scenario number one is that the virtualization of the profession gets us over that final hump of the fear of the digital, and that we're no longer arguing over the false binary of, is it better to draw things or represent them digitally? So that's a small bore victory, but I think it's a victory. The bigger, dreamier outcome, I think, along the lines of what Scott was saying, is the realization that not only do we have a lot of really interesting design problems out there, but architects are uniquely suited to not just decide how to repurpose an empty office building, but to look at the underlying issues of social equity and structural racism and many of the things that the built environment has instantiated physically, and begin to attack those problems as well. Yeah. Converting your abandoned office space is one thing. Providing, you know, places for people to live in the city where they can't afford to live is something entirely different.
Mm. Right. But they can be very closely connected. I think that's a great point, Phil. And I do think that it should take the blinders off our eyes, Dave, about the kinds of value that design thinking can bring to the table, not just in form making or connecting glass and concrete, but how cities actually operate, issues of health, safety, and welfare, public safety, social equity, all these things do swirl around the design professions. Somebody can figure that out. And I think if architects are smart, they'll realize, hey, wait a minute, my skill set can be applied in so many different ways and so many different problems. Let's get that design community to start talking about that stuff. And I think that the problems that are going to be presented to, let's say, the real estate development community, like, what am I going to do with empty office building? That goes straight to what Phil just said about, well, that could be a possible solution for the housing crisis. So all of a sudden, you see these rubbing these sticks together, you're getting some sparks to fly. And I think architects can be at the center of that conversation.
And the other thing I said to my students when this whole ordeal really started and they were all freaking out, we were all freaking out, was I said, guys, you know, this may be the last pandemic that I see in my lifetime, but it is not the last pandemic that you're going to see. What are you doing to learn from this situation as a human being, and a designer? What lessons can you take forward into the rest of your life and the rest of your career? Yeah. And I think there's some pretty big ones.
So, Phil, we talked earlier about episodic embrace and investment of technology as an enabler, but we've not fully exploited the value, the optimization that it could bring us. And we kind of press in and then we back off. We press in and we back off. The future of technology as essential to this dreamy world we're talking about, how do we break past our current paradigm? What decisions need to be made based on what awareness, I guess, is the question.
Well, I think that at the highest level, the answer to your question, Dave, has to do with redefining the role of technology in the overall continuum of the supply chain. And I'll give you a I'll give you an example of something that I'm thinking and working on right now. I'm co-teaching with a colleague from the law school a course called Fighting Slavery in the Building Supply Chain. And we are looking at the instantiation of forced labor into the American building industry. And I'm not talking about an ill-behaved Chinese contractor in New York enslaving some folks that he brought over from China. I'm talking about the guy who makes the charcoal that creates the smelter that runs, that creates the pig iron that goes to the steel fabricator that ends up in your building in Boston. There's really long distance between the designer and that problem. And one of the immediate strategies for dealing with a problem like that is to go, oh, that's a data management and supply chain problem. We could just use data to trace the provenance of everything and therefore know exactly who's making what and whether or not they've been properly paid. But the problem is the span of control from the client to the architect to the engineer to the contractor to the subcontractor to the sub-subcontractor to the fabricator to the supplier is so long and convoluted. And there is no common denominator that connects the process that it allows the use of technology in a way that is reinforcing to the entire supply chain. So the process problem exists in parallel with the technological problem. We have to create value propositions that allow technology to create value both for the individual players and for the entire supply chain. And you don't do that only with the technological strategy. You need a business proposition to go along with that. And structurally, I think that's the challenge.
Yeah. And I'll put it in simpler language. If I'm building a house, would I rather use a hammer or a nail gun? Well, I'd rather use a nail gun. It's faster, higher quality, fewer mistakes, and I can get the building done more quickly. And why wouldn't I do that if I had that tool available to me? So in the world of construction right now, the level of technology adoption is very, very low. But when you look about the implications of robotics and drones and all kinds of ways to manage the supply chain through, sophisticated logistics, like Amazon does. If you borrowed the Amazon model and applied it to a construction site, you have a whole different way of building buildings. So I think there's going to come a time when those things merge together. People are going to get smart out of necessity. There's a guy in Stanford by the name of John Koontz, now retired, who used to say that there's no reason why any building you want to build can't be done in 6 months or less, because we have the capacity right now to do it that fast and that well. But it's a nail gun versus hammer problem. A lot of people are just so familiar with hammers. That's what they know. That's what they like. That's what they use. But we have nail guns all around us. We should be using those nail guns.
To amplify that point, to go to one of the other topics we're talking about, Dave, yeah. Which is what's up with owners.
Yeah.
You look at the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world who are supply chain Zen masters, and you look at the Apples and the Googles and the Facebooks of the world who are data integration masters, and they apply none of the what they know about those disciplines to how they build their buildings. None. Zero. And so there's no, it's an indication of how segmented the supply chain is, even within the confines of a large-scale client like Amazon. I mean, I know architects who've worked for Amazon and Google, and they do have interesting ideas, and they are able to do interesting buildings. But it's not like Amazon looks at their architects and contractors and goes, you know what? We have all this expertise in supply chain optimization. We're going to apply our skills to this project and help you deliver it faster. They're just not wired that way. There's yeah. Those parts of the brain are completely separate.
And it is certainly not talked about in design school. And certainly not talked about in business school, even though it's staring us in the face as an issue. Nobody is really looking at this thing at the educational level.
Oh, Scott, don't you remember that time that you and I helped co-teach that class at Harvard Business School
yes.
on integrated project delivery? And we taught right. it to two 85-person HPS sections. And at the end of each class, we asked for a show of hands. After explaining, the building industry is 30% inefficient, so there are hundreds of billions of dollars lying on the table waiting for someone to go get them. Now right. raise your hand if you're interested in the building industry. And not one hand went up. Not one out of 170 students.
Yeah. I remember that moment. It was amazing. But, It's going to take Bezos or Jobs or somebody to come along and say, wait a minute, we can make sense out of this and blow the doors off the industry.
There are some indications that it's starting to happen, right? Our friends from McKinsey
are
being run out of other market sectors to sell to their venture capitalists are suddenly putting a ton of energy into construction. Same time that's happening, you're starting to see a lot of disorganized, who knows what's going on, technological innovation.
Right.
Under no coherent thesis, just throwing technological spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks.
Right.
But at least it's happening in our industry segment now.
Yeah, and this is a trillion-dollar industry with a 30% inefficiency rate. So there's $300 billion a year of stuff sitting there in the table to be redeployed in different ways. And it boggles my mind that people are not doing it.
Which takes us to the subject of risk. And we said this earlier, and Phil, maybe you could give us a primer on the industry and the design architectural industry and their response, or their, that's the best way to put it, their response to risk. And why are they so labeled as risk adverse?
Well, let me put on my professorial hat for a moment and take you back to two historical moments that I think are the genesis of this particular risk aversion DNA in our profession. So the first one, which was written about really, really elegantly by Charles Barnett Johnston down there in Atlanta at Georgia Tech.
Yep.
His recent book called Assembling the Architect, The History and Theory of Practice, it's really an extraordinary book. He talks about in that book a historical moment at the turn of the 20th century when the American architecture profession was beginning to become more formalized and structured, and the American economy had the demand for much more complex buildings. And up to that moment, there was no such thing as general contractors. Architects selected and ran the subcontractors and got their buildings built for clients. And there was a particular moment, inflection point, having to do with a standard contract that the AIA was writing, where the architectural profession in the form of the AIA decided they would rather be closer to clients than to builders, because they wanted to be closer to the gentleman class rather than the working class. And they essentially stepped away from the responsibility of managing construction and invented by default the discipline of construction management and general contracting. So that was the first big step away from the risk structure of building. Then the second moment came in the 1980s when we had a liability crisis during the time of social unrest, when access to the courts became much more widespread and people were hiring a lot of lawyers, and the lawyers were taking lawsuits on contingency, and there were a couple of recessions, so developers were trying to find sources of money, and insurance underwriting was extremely difficult to come by. And so the insurance industry began to say, if we're going to underwrite professional liability insurance, we're going to not allow architects to do the following things, X, Y, Z. And there was an enormous vacuum there where the profession never stepped up and said, this is what we want from the professional liability insurance industry. We let the insurance companies dictate the definition of risk. And I remember this vividly because in 1983, I had just gotten out of graduate school and we were being trained as young architects. And the only risk training for those of us who were interested in it came directly from the insurance companies. You know, I discovered later that when I was part of the contract documents committee of the AIA, that the insurance companies and the AIA completely in bed with one another, sponsoring each other's events. There's a very uncomfortable relationship there. So the profession itself has never taken the time to say, this is what we want to take responsibility for, and these are the value propositions that we want to define. We've allowed the insurance industry to tell us what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. And we followed that path. And it's been going on for 30 years now.
I agree with Phil. The aversion to risk is embedded, literally embedded in AIA contracts, where a very small percentage of the language talks about the value-added part of the service, which is schematic design, design development. And there are pages and pages about risk mitigation, arbitration, mediation, lawsuits, billing, all kinds of stuff that really don't add value to the process. But that's the primary focus of that contract, is about risk management. And this is a topic which is not addressed openly or directly in design schools, and really should be, because it's a major opportunity for architects to extend their influence. Take as much risk as you can and manage that risk is the way to get things done. And in my career, that's been my professional bent. In fact, when Phil and I worked together on the Autodesk job, we actually signed a contract guaranteeing price and schedule and guaranteeing zero change orders, which my insurance company thought was crazy, but we did it anyway. But there are people who do that, but they're fairly rare. But I think it starts in the schools. It starts in how we educate the expectations of the rising graduate generation. It starts in how we talk about these things and how we expect people to behave when they get out. And I've always been comfortable around risk. It doesn't bother me. But I agree with Phil that it's part of the DNA of the profession. And it's a big, big problem, because we're seeing now all kinds of opportunities coming our way. And we're not going to be able to take advantage of those opportunities if we're bound in our little cubicles of risk management and fear of engaging in different ways of doing business.
And of course, the pandemic, to tie this back to the earlier conversation, is another one of these opportunities that's come up for the profession, where if the history of the last several decades is any indication, the profession will simply say, nope, not going to take any responsibility for that. Asbestos, not interested. Construction costs, not interested. Yeah. Scheduling, not interested. The list goes on. So somebody's going to do this. Yeah. Is it going to be us? Again, to tie this discussion to something we talked about a little bit earlier, many of the technical, very practical, quantitative kinds of issues that could be correlated to risk assumption can be simulated and predicted with appropriate technologies. Right. Indoor air quality being an excellent example. Virus transmission can be modeled to a certain extent. Sure. Construction costs can be monitored. There are lots of ways to apply technology, but there has to be a reciprocal value proposition. I'm not going to take the risk unless I get the return.
Right. And that goes back to the conundrum about it being a transactional business where you get your fees paid before the building is open, but the value starts accruing only after the building is in service. So there's no bridge there. There's no way to do what you're suggesting, because we haven't got the contracts to reflect that.
Well, we can make the contracts.
Yeah, we can.
The contracts are the last mile of this value proposition network.
Agreed.
We can always write contracts.
Yeah.
What we need is the design of the business model. And IPD was one strategy for dealing with that. I'm sure there are others.
I think that, when I was doing a lot of work in M&A, we never talked about risk management. It was always you don't manage risk. You mitigate risk, you eliminate risk, or you arbitrate risk, but you don't manage it. It's not like you can put a bridle in its mouth. It's all about risk awareness. And once you understand what the risks possibly are, you have your choices through that. And so there's this idea that in the educational continuum, if there was more of a core piece of curriculum around this idea of risk awareness and navigation through that risk, it could radically alter how some of these students are coming out and are addressing opportunities that are in front of them. On the other end of the continuum is the insurers, this gap that was left in silence, and they spoke first and dictated, and boom, here we are. But we have this technology today, albeit not being as exploited as it could be, to be able to have proof points and defensible arguments, it would seem to me, to push back on some of the onerous dictates from the insurers, because we have the evidence to show it if we were doing this appropriately.
Good luck with that, Dave.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Good luck trying to extract data. I've been asking those guys for years for some kind of data that could provide a guidance for a strategy that would correlate a new definition of risk in the building industry. And you just can't get the data from them. They just will not give it up.
Well, they have everything to lose.
Here's my fantasy about that, Dave. You got a complicated project which is full of risks, and you simply make a requirement for the architect, the owner, the engineers, and the consultants all to use the same insurance company. So if they want to sue each other, they're suing through the same insurance company, and those claims are settled in a flash, because it makes no difference at that point.
So this has just been a fantastic conversation. There's so much more, so I'd love to get back on at another time and unpack some more, and we'll call it part two. Phil, Scott, thank you so much for being with me today, and we're going to look forward to coming back for part two.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Dave. Looking forward to the next go-round.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of This Is Design Intelligence, sponsored by the Tricord Group and VIM. The producer for This Is Design Intelligence is Laura Spells. Sound engineering by Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.